Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show...
Almost all films are inspired by incidents in life that you hear about or you learn about, and then you go your own way to kind of serve your own story.
Yes, Israel's Eran Riklis tells Film Weekly about the inspiration behind his new film, Lemon Tree, a David and Goliath story that involves legal wrangles, the search for identity, and lots of lemons. And
I've often done things where I didn't think that my character was perhaps the best in it or the one that I'd really like to do the most, but I've just done it because I thought the story was so compelling.
British actress Sophie Okonedo not only knows how to spot a good story, but lands a lead role in The Secret Life of Bees amongst a stellar American lineup, including Queen Latifah and Alicia Keys. Sophie will be telling me what it was like to work with the Queens of Soul. More of that later. And Zan Brooks will be here as ever. We review The Day the Earth Stood Still with Keanu Reeves as an alien. Israeli director Eran Riklis came to international prominence with his excellent 2004 film The Syrian Pride, which, debuting at Cannes, traced the inhuman political barriers to the very human desire to marry. With his new film Lemon Tree, Riklis once again springs from a seemingly simple starting point to tell a complex story of identity and power struggle in contemporary Israel. Lemon Tree tells of a battle by a poor Palestinian woman, Salma, to save her lemon grove against an Israeli order to tear it down. The order is justified as a measure from on high needed to protect the safety of her neighbour, who just happens to be the new Israeli defence minister. So when I met up with Eran Riklis, I started by asking him how he came across the story of the lemon trees. But first, let's get a citric flavour of his film Lemon Tree.
Yeah, I think what I felt immediately when I came up with the idea and I kind of based it on, you know, really real elements, was it has all the ingredients. You know, it has the land, it has the history, it has the roots, it has the people. In my case, you know, it has the woman, the lonely woman kind of fighting the system, you know, which is great. So it's like a local Irene Brockovich in a way.
Yes.
And you know, I felt it also has the humor, which was important for me because, you know, I didn't want to make a film which is kind of, you know, totally kind of heavy about these heavy issues and everything. So I really felt, you know, it has everything and I can't really resist it.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what were the true elements? What was the real story that made into the Israeli press and I think the world press as well?
I'm not sure about the world press because, curiously enough, it didn't make, you know, headlines. It was just really a small kind of one-time piece about a woman, a very old woman, actually, who had olive trees, not lemon trees, and who, you know, whose neighbor was the then current Minister of Defense. And she decided, you know, I'm not going to let you cut my trees because of some weird security needs. And then she went to court. And she also got all the way up to the Supreme Court. So, you know, the essence of the storyline is basically the same. The essence of the story is different in the sense of, you know, this whole connection between the Palestinian woman and the wife of the minister, and the whole way the minister treats the thing, because I think in reality the minister didn't really bother about it at all. And, you know, the whole relationship with the lawyer, so it's like the Palestinian lawyer, so it's really about, I think it's like everything. I think everything, you know, almost all films are inspired by incidents in life that you hear about or you learn about, and then you go your own way to kind of serve your own story.
But as an Israeli filmmaker, there must be more incidents per capita or per filmmaker that in Israel than there are in probably anywhere else in the world at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's incredible. It probably accounts for the fact that, you know, films are keep kind of coming out of Israel recently. But I think it's always been like that. I think what changed in Israel now is that there's a growing one. I think it's not strong enough yet. A growing awareness of Israeli filmmakers that, you know, we really have to deal with these issues. And when I say these issues, I don't necessarily mean, you know, Palestinians. It's, you know, it can be political issues, it can be social issues, it can be whatever. But I think, you know, we cannot live in a bubble. It's like, you know, we really, it's a difficult place, difficult country, difficult relationships with the surrounding countries, and we have to deal with it. You know, I think it's our duty in a way.
Yeah, so as an Israeli filmmaker, it's almost impossible to make a film that is apolitical. I mean, everything in Israel is political. Every move you make is kind of touched by politics on one side or the other, be they family, be they macro politics, geopolitics. When you set out to make a film, do you think, well, you know, what's the best way that I can touch on these themes and yet kind of be as apolitical or satirical? I suppose you can kind of do as you wish, but I say, we had Ari Folman, the director of Waltz with Bashir, on the show a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that was a very political film, but dealt with in a completely different format and form.
Yes. Well, you know, in a strange way, I find it easy to deal with these things because I use, you know, a few key words, you know, honesty, and truth and emotion, you know. And I sort of say, okay, you know, the facts are the facts. Facts can always be manipulated in whatever way you want to manipulate them, and you never know what is the real truth. But I think if you come with honesty to your subject and you sort of tell the story, you paint it with a lot of colors, not in black and white, and you sort of let the audience judge. So I really try to make democratic films, in a sense. I don't try to impose, you know, of course, you know, hey, I'm a director, I manipulate the image, I manipulate the story, and yet I really try to respect the audience and sort of say to myself, okay, if it's an audience that is with me from the beginning, great, enjoy the show. If it's not, if it's kind of against my kind of politics, okay, I'm here to try and persuade you that it's more complex than you really think, yeah. You know?
It was interesting watching your film, Eran, and your previous film, such as Syrian Bride. You have a style of directing that I would say belongs more into the realm of Arab cinema. It reminds me of Kiarostami, Iranian cinema. It's a very high compliment, of course, to be compared to that master, but it's that kind of look, Makmal Baf, that kind of look. It may be just that you choose dusty settings that could be something to do with that. But it's that it has a more kind of fabulistic way of storytelling rather than, say, a Hollywood influence.
Absolutely. You know, it's a good observation, and thank you for the compliment, but it's I think it has to do with the fact that, you know, as a kid, I grew up in America. So I was influenced strongly by American cinema and, you know, American television, even. I'm talking, you know, 50s and 60s. And yet, you know, I went to film school in this country, the National Film School in Beaconsfield. I was influenced, you know, by European traditions.
Right.
And then, you know, more so by Asian traditions, you know, Iranian, Chinese, whatever. And I think in the end, I'm a mix. And I think what it means from that point of view is that I make films which are, okay, they have that kind of, you know, European, Asian quality, and yet they're communicative, and they can appeal to an audience, you know, in London, New York, you know, the most sophisticated places on earth, simply because they do use tools which are tools of, you know, easy communication. And, you know, for me, I always say, you know, even, you know, of course, Lemon Tree belongs to the kind of what we call in general the art house kind of world of cinema, and yet I'll be happy if it's shown in a multiplex and people, you know, they can chew popcorn throughout the screen. I don't care.
Or lemonade.
Even better.
but it has, as you say, it's got this lone woman fighting the system, this courtroom drama aspect. So it has that almost got a Hollywood coating, if you like.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think really in Lemon Tree it really shows that, and you know, even The Syrian Bride, which was a kind of, you know, wedding day on a kind of frontier. So it's all, you know, it was a bit of a Western. It was a bit of kind of, you know, classic wedding film, like, you know, Altman's kind of a wedding. And so I think it's always nice to kind of be very close to stereotypes and cliches in a way and use them in a kind of new way, you know. And so I had all the ingredients of, you know, what is Lemon Tree? It could also be a kind of Western. It could also be a kind of, you know, a struggle over land in Ireland, the kind of bloody story between Catholics and, you know, whatever.
What I wondered, Aaron, is that we talked with Ari Folman about the kind of new wave of Israeli films, which is very impressive at the moment in the international stage, in Israel itself. Is there a little group of you? Are you conscious of a wave? Are you sitting down in cafes in Tel Aviv, like Godard and Truffaut, and kind of drawing up rules, or the Dogma movement, or are you just a disparate band of mavericks?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know what Ari said about this, but, you know, I know Ari, and I think we never had a drink together. It's a strange situation because when I came back from England, actually, you know, 20 years ago after film school, as I said, that's exactly what I want to do, you know, create a kind of French new wave kind of sense with Israelis. It never happened. I think it's not in the Israeli kind of, you know, character to kind of join forces, especially not directors. I think because we struggle so difficult, you know, to get a film off the ground. It's so difficult that it has to be kind of maverick kind of thing. And right. So in the end, I think we are a group of people who probably think the same way about filmmaking and about politics and et cetera. And yet we're all on our own. And I guess it has to change at some point.
Eran Riklis, thank you for coming on Film Weekly.
Thank you very much.
And my thanks to Eran Riklis there. Lemon Tree is on nationwide release in the UK from Friday, the 12th of December. You're listening to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons, and it's that time in the show when I'm now joined in the film pod by Guardian film critic at large and roving reporter. He roves into the pod now. Zan Brooks is back. You've been in Copenhagen, Zan.
Yes, I've been roving further afield than Farringdon Road this week. Yeah, I was in Copenhagen for the European Film Awards.
Oh, did you win?
I didn't, and I knew I wasn't going to win because my table's right at the back. That's always the kind of clue, isn't
it's
it?
A marker.
And you're not going to get called to the stage.
Yeah, who was?
Gamora, again and again and again. Gamora kind of swept the board, really, with five awards, including Best Film and Best Director. And also Judi Dench won a Lifetime Achievement Award. There was also another Lifetime Achievement Award for the Dogma founders, Lars von Trier, Thomas Vinterberg, et al.
Were they all there?
They were all there.
Wow.
Yeah.
A bit of vodka consumed.
I'm sure. Yeah. I actually went over to try and get an interview, and Lars von Trier looked at me and said, "No, please, no."
Thought you were the Vat Man.
I think he sees enemies everywhere, Lars.
Yes, I think you're right. But Copenhagen, a good place for the European Film Award?
It was a very nice place. It's a very handsome, respectable, seemed very well-adjusted city. And I think the awards seem kind of well-adjusted too. I mean, something like the BAFTAs, I've never been entirely convinced by the tone because... in one regard, they're a celebration of British film, but they're also part of sort of an Oscar warm-up act.
Yeah.
And they're trying to kind of look two ways, whereas the European Film Awards are kind of unapologetically about European cinema.
Yeah, and it's pretty arthousey up there.
I mean, it's pretty arthouse. And, you know, the nominations for Best Picture were Waltz with Bashir, Il Divo, The Orphanage, Waltz, it was a good lineup, The Class. So this is a kind of quality, not quantity
kind
of award.
Interesting at the European Film Awards that Gomorrah beat The Class, whereas in Cannes, The Class beat Gomorrah just by coming in at the end.
Yeah, which shows that even within the small goldfish bowl of European cinema, there are a lot of kind of differences, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I love Gomorrah, I love The Class anyway, but nice to see Gomorrah winning out. And a Best Actor Award for Tony Servillo there as well, who's one of the fine Italian actors.
Absolutely.
Also in Il Divo there. Zan, let's come back to Earth, in fact, with the first release of the week. It's The Day the Earth Stood Still. Jennifer Connelly is trying to save the world in her white coat. Keanu Reeves is a man not of this planet.
My name is Regina Jackson. I'm the Secretary of Defense of the United States of America.
This body will take some getting used to.
I've been sent here to determine who or what you represent and what your intentions are.
It feels unreal to me. Alien. It will take time to adapt.
What were you before you were human?
Different.
Different how?
It would only frighten you.
So this is a remake of Robert Wise's celebrated B-movie, a sci-fi movie. Does it translate into the modern era?
No, not at all. It's one of those films. Earlier this year, we had another film called Meet Dave, in which Eddie Murphy plays a sort of alien spaceship disguised as Eddie Murphy. And that looked like it was kind of made by space aliens. And this one does too. This is just... supposedly taking place on Earth, but it bears no relation to the Earth that we know, or even a kind of convincing science fiction fantasy world.
It really is rubbish, this film, isn't it? It's kind of one of the worst things ever made, I think.
It's shockingly bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, they know it as well, because it's edited all over the place.
Yeah.
It's quite ridiculous.
Everyone looks faintly embarrassed.
Yeah, Jennifer Connelly, we were going to have her on the show, but she couldn't, I actually interviewed her, and I was like, she thinks she's in a good film.
She surely does.
She does. Well, she was trying manfully or womanfully to kind of pretend that she was. So I'm not even going to give her the airtime, I'm afraid. You just get me and Zan, because she's going, oh, well, I had a really good time making the movie. I'm like, Jennifer!
But she might have had a really good time making the film, but none of that actually comes across on screen. She plays a kind of kindly scientist in a white lab coat.
She's an astrobiologist.
and an astrobiologist with a mentor who is played by John Cleese, who is a Nobel Prize winning biologist. And if you thought that casting is kind of curious, then we've still got to kind of tackle Kathy Bates as the US Secretary of Defense and Keanu Reeves as a space alien, which is weirdly the most appropriate casting of all.
He hasn't been human for a very long time.
He hasn't been human for a long time.
We've suspected
And he's
this.
Keanu plays Klaatu, which is just a little short skippity hop away from his real persona, I guess.
It really is. I mean, he probably kind of comes out of it best of all, because he can be in any old rubbish Keanu Reeves, and he's still Keanu Reeves. It's fine.
Yes, exactly.
He's kind of Teflon, isn't he?
Yeah.
So he's probably like an alien. But I love it when she sort of says, oh, those aren't our leaders. He's going, your leaders are going to destroy the world. And he says, oh, those aren't our leaders. I'll take you to one. And you kind of, well, who is this man? Bono, perhaps? And I made a silly, facetious note. Could be Bono. It's not. It's John Cleese, who is the leader. He's the cleverest man in the world.
Cleverest man in the world.
It's got
and
a beautiful
so
house.
Basically, the world's future depends on Basil Fawlty.
It really does. And then he says, we can change. It is absolute nonsense.
Oh, it's just, you kind of watch it with your jaw hanging, don't you?
Yeah.
And
I did laugh quite a lot, though.
Yeah, but yeah. I think it's a defence mechanism. When the world's going to be destroyed by Keanu Reeves, the only possible response is to laugh.
Wonderful. And there is, I have to say, for aficionados of London in Hollywood movies, there is the classic shot of Westminster Bridge, a double-decker bus, yeah, and Big Ben. That is London.
That is London.
Done.
And Winston Churchill smoking a cigar by the bridge.
Brilliant. That's the day the Earth stood still, and we shall leave it there. Zan, let's move on to The Man from London. A very interesting film from Hungarian auteur, maestro, and oft kind of scourge of film critics, as he makes films that are last 400 minutes. Here is a whiz-bang short version, only 2.5 hours, of The Man from London by Bela Tarr.
This is his sprint, isn't it?
Yeah, it's his little short that he's just dashed off.
This is based on a Georges Simenon thriller, which is slightly misleading because that leads you then to expect a thriller, doesn't it? And this is a very Bela Tarr kind of thriller in that it doesn't really go anywhere, and it takes an awful lot of long time getting there. But for all that, it's kind of gripping. Mm. It's sort of compelling in a sort of very odd way. Bela Tarr is kind of unique, but if he has any possible sort of transatlantic cousin, it might be David Lynch, in that they both kind of conjure up these kind of very woozy, almost narcotic kind of dreamscape, yeah, worlds. What Lynch has that Bela Tarr doesn't is the sort of the strange wackiness and the kind of flamboyance.
Bit of humour.
And Bela doesn't really do jokes.
Yeah, although funny enough, in this one, there is some sort of skewed black humour in it. This is the story of a railway signalman who witnesses some kind of murder, then pulls a bag of money out of the thing, but then gets all guilty about his money and then can't carry on because it's all going mad and he's got so much money and he's married to Tilda Swinton, and then he buys his daughter a fur throw. But there's no noirish elements in it, really. There's no mystery. And then some inspector comes and speaks very slowly.
Yes, and exactly. Normally in a thing like this, the bag of loot is, that defines the plot. So then it's like, who's going to get the bag of loot?
Yeah.
And there's a chase and things like that. This just has him kind of staring at this bag of loot, pondering what he's going to do with it. And there's a sort of brooding air of menace. There's a superb, I think, sense of the kind of this sort of French harbour landscape that the camera kind of moves very slowly through.
Yeah, beautiful.
And it certainly has a power and a potency to it. And yet it is going to test the patience, I think.
It really is, I think, Zan. So that's The Man from London. But it's just kind of interesting. I saw it in Cannes 18 months ago. It was in Hungarian, definitely in Hungarian. Everyone wrote, oh, Tilda Swinton is in Hungarian. But I watched it this time. She's now in French, but in her own French. She is speaking French. And I know this because I interviewed her last week and she did a little French when she said La vie rêvée des anges. She speaks French like an A-level student. And she's dubbed her own French
in the new version. This is a very odd film, isn't it? And by the DVD release, they'll be singing ABBA songs.
I think so. And probably that could fly off the shelves. Bela Tarr doing Mamma Mia. Now that's something. So let's move on over the border to Mexico for the child napping sex trafficking thriller Trade, which curiously stars Kevin Klein as a cop trying to find his own disappeared daughter, striking up a relationship with a Mexican boy who stows away in search of his own disappeared sister.
Look, mister, you can't take me to the police.
Well, I have to.
They'll send me back and I gotta stay here. I'm looking for my little sister. She was kidnapped. I'm not kidding, man.
Sure.
My sister, she's just 13. They took her in Mexico City and I followed them to all the way to that house in Juarez.
What house?
You know the house. You were there. Please, mister, I need to get to New Jersey.
Why New Jersey?
To find her! It's my fault she got taken! If you're a cop, boy, you can't help me!
I'm not that kind of cop.
Zan, Trade, it's a kind of Hollywood take on the old South American cinema.
It is. This is a film that reminds us, lest there be any doubt, that the international sex trade is a very bad thing indeed.
It is.
There we were all thinking it was a bit of fun. And then along comes this film that reminds us just how evil it is. And it does so in the most sort of crassest possible way, with lots of sort of anguished close-ups and mournful Latin guitar. And even, I think, at one stage, a single red rose dropped on the street as a sort of sign of lost innocence.
Waiting for for Antonio Banderas to come along as the Mask of Zorro and pick it up.
It's a very crude film. And of course, it has its heart in the right place and is saying the right things. And yet does so in such a kind of cheesy Hollywood manner that you kind of almost find yourself resisting it.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of starts badly. And I thought it was grim and exploitative and all the kind of girls getting raped and the Polish girls getting whipped off the bus and kind of straight into the sex trade. And then the kids, and everyone gets kidnapped. Just everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you think, but then it sort of develops into something a bit different when Kevin Kline pops up. You think, is that Kevin? That is Kevin Kline,
isn't
it?
Kevin Kline. It's a very strange role for him to do. Yes, it does get better. I think that the second half is a bit better. I could have done without the kind of slight buddy comedy of Kevin Kline and the Mexican kid sort of sparring on the road on the way up to New Jersey.
It reminded me of Julia last week with Tilda Swinton.
It did, yeah, it's going in the opposite direction. I know. This is a little trend here. And yet it does have a kind of a neat climax. It's got a good tense scene at the end where they finally kind of arrive at the safe house where they have to bid in this auction to win this
that's
teenage
all quite good,
girl back.
Isn't it?
All that was kind of good. And then, it wrecks it again with a sort of terrible little epilogue with a ending on... Any film that kind of ends on a freeze frame, I think, and a cry of Papa, which it does, is not to be recommended.
Back on El Street, still Mexico.
Yeah, and just the crime will just go on and on. I mean, that's the message.
Don't go there, Americans. We've seen a lot of that with Maria Fuller Grace, with Sequestro Express, with the kind of turistas in Brazil. Very dangerous, America.
Very dangerous. Stay in San Antonio.
Because Sarah Palin's advert, I think. There's a post-Barack, we're going to see a lot more kind of welcoming films. That's Trade, Zan. And just before we go, a little snow is falling, Zan. Get us in a Christmassy mood.
Snow. It won't be long before we...
I'm not going to sing it, but we can say it. We can say White Christmas is being re-released. The old Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye sort of quasi-classic. Is it actually seen as a classic? I don't know.
Is it any good?
It's a sort of treasure, isn't it?
It is.
Well, I don't think it's as good as Holiday Inn, which
was
the other.
Which was based,
yeah. But I think it's a perennial, isn't it? I had a weird thing about this where I thought, surely they don't need to re-release it at the cinema because it's always on TV over Christmas anyway. And then I thought, well, maybe it's not.
Yeah, maybe something.
Maybe I'm thinking back to my own childhood and watching it on TV, and now you've just got kind of the X Factor Christmas special, and they don't actually show these old chestnut
movies
anymore.
I think it might be on
TCM anymore.
Somewhere. So
probably.
It's probably worth going to see the Technicolor magic.
I think so.
Of Bing et al. In White Christmas. Zan, thank you very much as ever.
Thank you.
You're listening to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. The lovely British actress Sophie Okonedo has landed on her feet, a starring role in a starry American film, The Secret Life of Bees, alongside Queen Latifah, Alicia Keys, Jennifer Hudson, Dakota Fanning, and our own Paul Bettany. When I met up with Sophie, we discussed filming in the deep south of America and her stellar career, which began way, way back in 1991 in Young Soul Rebels and has taken in films such as This Year's Love, Dirty Pretty Things, Hotel Rwanda, and of course, Tsunami, The Aftermath.
You think something being an impossibility makes you think about it even more?
Like what?
I don't know. Like kissing.
That ain't impossible. When I was 15, I made a 7-up cake with this boy. After that, he kissed me all the time.
What'd it feel like?
Like I was gonna burst.
Sophie Okonedo, how lovely to see you. Congratulations on The Secret Life of Bees. You've got your hair rather differently today, though.
I have, yeah, not in little girly plaits.
what's it like when you get a part with a massive American ensemble like that? I know you had your mate Paul Bettany kind of keeping up the British flag.
I did, yeah. Well, I hadn't really done anything like that before, so it was... It was extraordinary because there were such sort of iconic women, you know, they're really big stars. And I was cast quite early on, so I knew that Dakota was doing it, and then I heard that Queen was doing it, and then...
Is that what you call a Queen?
I call her Dana, I think, usually.
Really? Yeah, because, yeah. But you...
But then, for a time, she quite liked La, so we called her that for a while.
Have you been a fan since you were 11?
I always thought she was just, you know, really fantastic, sort of force of nature type person. Yeah. I've always, you know, really liked her. But she's really hilarious. She's very, very funny, very bright. Had a very good time. She makes the atmosphere very warm.
I suppose it's... I don't know the novel myself before I saw this. I don't know if you were familiar with it.
Even
before you knew about the film.
She sent the book about 3 years ago by the film company, and there was a different director doing it at that point. So I went to meet him, and he said, "Oh, what part do you feel close to?" I said, "Well, May," straight away. And then I didn't hear anything about it, you know, for a long time. And at that point, there wasn't really... Oh, there had been a script written, but I read the novel anyway. And then Gina, you know, took on the movie, and she asked for me to play May without even knowing I wanted to play her.
So why were you attracted to May as well? Because she's not immediately, it's hard to cast. I wouldn't have thought, you know, Sophie's perfect for this.
I don't know. I couldn't imagine myself doing it. I thought the other parts, there's other people they could get for that. They're probably more right. And I think I'm quite a character actress.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably the sort of part that I would suit.
When you choose projects, is it as, you know, it is something as like, oh, this looks a great thing to be involved with. This is a good story.
I have lots of different criteria for why I do a job. But it's just usually my gut instinct. It's the story. It's always the story, even more than my particular character. I've often done things where I didn't think that my character was perhaps the best in it, or the one that I'd really like to do the most, but I've just done it because I thought the story was so compelling.
That Dirty Pretty Things were on the telly the other night, saw
it. I missed it. I really wanted to see it because I've seen it just once years ago, so I'd love to see it again.
Yeah, you're a prostitute.
I am a prostitute in that. I am. Yeah, very nice prostitute.
Yeah, start with a heart.
Yeah.
Well, literally, I suppose, there's a heart.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
I forgot about that. Because it was on again, and I did catch it. I didn't even know I was coming to see you at that point. And I just thought, God, what a sort of moment film it is. What I was going to say important, but it's not important. That's it. Just kind of the cast, the kind of London that it captures, and the people that are in it, i.e. yourself and Chiwetel.
Yeah.
I thought it was such a film that kind of started a whole, almost a movement as well in both of your careers.
Yeah, it really did. That was real. I mean, I have to thank Stephen Frears for that. I mean, I didn't think, because it wasn't that big a part, but it really kick-started a film career, which I didn't really think I was... I knew I'd always do theatre, and I knew I'd get my tellies, but I didn't ever think I'd really perhaps have a film career into my 30s. I just thought it'd kind of passed me by. And just from that film, it was more successful in America, I think, than it was here. They really loved it in America, and everyone in the business watched it. So, you know, and that's how I got Hotel Rwanda, was from that film. I'm not quite sure why Terry George thought, well, from seeing me play a prostitute, I could play a Rwandan refugee, but somehow he saw that's why he called me in.
Where do things like this take you? You know what I mean? Is that people see you as part of an ensemble with Queen Latifah, Alicia Keys, Jennifer Hudson, you know, so give me that girl. You know, it could be really, you know, huge for your career.
Yeah, I don't know. It's because things always just seem to come in when I least expect it. I mean, I've got a film, which I don't know when it's coming out, called Skin, which I did in South Africa not long ago, about, and it's a British film, about a British and South African film, about a woman called Sandra Lang, who's a real person, it's a true story, and she was born in the 50s, in the sort of height of apartheid, to two white Afrikaner parents. Mm-hmm. And she's a genetic throwback, so she's black, born to two white parents. Right. And it's her life story. So that should be coming out next year.
That must have chimed with you a bit, because your mother's white, isn't she?
Yeah, she's next door here, actually. She is, so it was very... I could use a lot of myself. I always use myself in everything.
Yeah,
you know, people always say, what's like you? It's all like me. Yeah. I mean, you just turn up a notch here, bring it down a bit there.
So, brilliant. Well done, Sophie.
Thank you very much, Jason. Okay.
A huge thanks to the lovely Sophie Okonedo there. And The Secret Life of Bees is already on UK-wide release as we speak. That's all we've got time for, alas, this week. Thanks to my guests, Sophie Okonedo, Erin Rickliss, and, of course, Zan Brooks. Do pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer to read my Trailer Trash column, as well as a little review of the party year and the best of film reviews and news. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.